Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
And we are back, and we are happy to be with you here on another edition of our movies podcast, the 80s, the 90s, and more. It is We've Seen That. I am your humble host, TJ Reeves. We're coming to you here, at least I am, in the midst of March Madness at the time that we're taping. So I'm a little crazed. I'm a little travel weary. We've got the baseball season starting as well, and that's going to tie right into this week's movie. So let me say hello to my co-host, Howdy Patna, to the famous J.J. Betzel in Dallas-Fort Worth. How are you? And I know you're anxious like I am that not only do we have college basketball, but baseball is not going to be far behind that.
This is just such a great time of year. We've got the NBA playoffs are almost here, the Stanley Cup playoffs are almost here, the NFL draft, I mean, you name it. This is just a fun time to be a sports fan.
But in particular, it is the start of a new baseball season before too much longer. And you and I are big baseball fans. You love your Rangers in Texas. I have the Rays here. Love to be around the Rays, the local team. And so we've got a little baseball theme coming on. We've seen that here today.
You are correct. We're talking about For Love of the Game. And a lot of this, when you're watching it, it's very nostalgic. Because, you know, a couple times during the movie, they'll mention how Kevin Costner's character, Billy Chappell, is old school. And this is kind of just an old school, you know, movie. It's a love story. It's a sports movie. It's got a little bit of everything. Everybody.
And I think everybody's going to enjoy that. I should make mention, too, if you're not aware of this, whether you found us through RadioInfluence.com or however you found the show through social media, you can subscribe via iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, tune in wherever your podcasts are found. Just search under We've Seen That. You can follow us on social media as well at We've Seen That on Twitter and on Facebook to keep up with our show. And you and I have done some baseball movies before. We'll talk about that as we go along here on We've Seen That. But this is going to be a fun one. Here we go with the 20th anniversary of For the Love of the Game.
Billy Chappell is 40 years old, arm weary and aching. And you know, Steve, I have a feeling Billy Chappell isn't pitching against the Yankees. He's pitching against time.
Chappell, you suck!
You can always tell when I'm in New York.
And tonight, he might be able to use that aching old arm one more time to push the sun back up in the sky and give us one more day of summer.
That'll fix it.
Thank you. You saved my day.
You like baseball?
What?
Would you like to go to a baseball game with me?
Billy, if she don't want to go, I'll go.
How do you like to be kissed?
Gotten your heart broken?
Yeah, when we lost the pennant in 87.
So are you my mom's boyfriend?
I'm not sure.
But you've slept with her.
I need a regular guy, not the guy on the Old Spice commercial.
It was right guard.
I was being metaphorical.
Little boys buy cards with your picture on
them.
They
buy those for the gum.
What's the problem, Billy? Talk to me.
You don't want to talk. You just want to give me your version of why she'd quit. I mean, haven't you ever loved anything that much? I don't know if I have anything left.
You just throw whatever you got, whatever's left. The boys are all here for you. We're going to be awesome for you right now.
You can win or lose the game all by yourself. You don't need me.
Don't go.
There you have it. For Love of the Game, it was released September 17th, 1999 by Universal Pictures. It opened up at number two for the week. It's grossed $13 million its opening weekend. The number one film was also new that week. It starred Martin Lawrence, Blue Streak. It beat For Love of the Game in the opening, and when all was said and done, we adjust for ticket price like we'd like to do, it grossed $62.5 million. So a modest hit. You know, it made its money back, and it was one of those movies that a lot of people might not have seen at the theater because September's kind of a weird time to go to the movies. You got people starting back to school, you know, football season, high school football, a lot of places, Florida and Texas where we are. So the Friday night might not be the first thing at the movie, but this one, it served its purpose. And so obviously the reason we're doing this is we both like it. What do you like so much about this movie? What made you want to do it?
Two or three different things. Number one, I'm a big Costner fan. I think you are too. I love sports movies when they're intertwined. And in this case, there's a love story that I think that works here. And Costner has done this, and we'll get into this in other movies as we go along and talk about this. But it intrigued me from the beginning because I remember, 10 years earlier, he had done Bull Durham, which is a sports movie comedy, but also intertwines the love story with Crash and Annie, with Susan Sarandon as his love interest. So it's a recurring theme with Costner, right? I mean, he's going to have the lead character, but there's got to be some kind of love interest somehow, some way in almost all of his movies, right?
Yeah, and in Bull Durham, he was the catcher, Crash Davis. And Bull Durham has so many funny parts. It's just one of those iconic movies you can think back and laugh to, you know, no matter what part of the movie it is, whatever he's got Nuke doing, whether he's breathing through his eyelids or, you know, whatever's going on. But this one is much more serious. And he's, you know, and the one thing that the characters have in common is Crash Davis is towards the end of his career. You know, he's down in the minor leagues, taking care of of Nuke LaLoosh. You know, he's kind of working for the organization, and they're like, you know, if you want to keep coming to the ballpark and keep getting paid to do it, you can help us with this pitcher, right? So you remember he kind of kicks things around the office. He's like, you know, this isn't what I wanted, you know. But you flip it around to his character for Love of the Game, he is a surefire Hall of Famer, you know, who is at the end of his career, and as we'll get into the movie, you know, he kind of finds out things, the same type of thing, just in a different way.
Well, and we love in sports, we love great stories, great moments. And that's the whole movie is based around what is going to become a great story or a great moment at the end of his career. That's why it works. It's storytelling through a baseball game, what is going to turn out to be the final baseball game of his career. So that's another reason why it works. So we often go back and forth, you and me, about being in the theater. I was not in the theater in this one, in this case, in the fall of 1999, but I do vividly remember watching it with my wife, with Mrs. Reeves, after the fact. I have to tell the audience, just being honest on, we've seen that, I like this movie. Mrs. Reeves, not a big fan. She may hear this at some point. She was not a big fan of this one, but what about for you? Did you see this one in the theater, or was this a later on video or DVD rental?
I did see it in the theater, and back when we did our episode on Dave and the American President, remember we talked about the sneak previews they used to do where they'd show the movie a week early on a Saturday night, and then it would be released the following Friday? I saw it on a Saturday night before it came out, and I really liked it. You know, the beauty about seeing those sneak previews is they were usually a packed theater. You know, people were cheering. They're all into it and stuff, and kind of like we mentioned earlier, it's one of those movies where, you know, some for everybody. You can have the girls that are watching the love story can get onto that. And because the movie goes back and forth, the flashbacks kind of throughout his life, you know, it has the intensity and the excitement of the baseball game kind of intertwined with his story. So everybody that was in the theater liked it, got people are clapping. You know, we mentioned when on the Rocky episode we did about people cheering. That's kind of how this one was for me. And that's why I remember it, basically.
So so on the sneak preview, was that something that you were invited to or that you just paid for because it was a one-time showing in advance and you knew about this movie and you wanted to see it in advance? Or how did that work?
It was something they used to do it a long time ago, back before the movies were coming out Thursdays, where like the week before they would release it and it would be a one-time show Saturday night, 7-8 o'clock, and you'd buy a ticket and you could stay and watch another movie for free. Like if it's with Universal, whatever Universal movie was out at that time, you could probably stay and watch it because they'd show it in place of it at 8 o'clock. It's kind of like a two for the price of one.
I love it, and I love how that's a good tactic, and I love how they would always use the phraseology things like advanced screening, like it's an advanced screening, like it's an even bigger deal, like a Hollywood premiere, the premiere before the premiere, to make you feel good. I can say that I have seen some movies in advance, but those have been special screenings. I'm obviously in the media and do a lot of stuff in the media where they will invite the media and the media to bring a guest for a special screening. But I would love to see more of that. Even in the present day, we're now in 2019 at the time that we're taping this. If you have the opportunity to go see it in advance, publicize it, put it out there. I like that. A week in advance if you know enough about the movie. And at this time period, to bring it back to Kevin Costner, He had been rolling along and made a lot of different big movies. There would be a reason to do an advanced screening, an advanced showing for one of his movies. That's the point, right?
Correct. Right. It's kind of one of those deals where back then it would help you get the word out because so much of it was word of mouth, right? You know, you could tell your friends, hey, I saw this Costner movie and it comes out next week. You know, it's kind of one of those deals. And remember when he made this one, he had made Tin Cup in 96, but then he had The Postman in 97, which was not well received at all. So he was kind of in rebound mode. He'd done Message in a Bottle, and he made this one both in 1999 that were, you know, kind of more for the female audience, if you will, from Message in a Bottle. And, you know, this was kind of one of those things where he kind of went back to what he knew because people love seeing him in the baseball movies. So he's like, here, I'm going to give the fans what they want, and made another baseball movie.
And what's so interesting to go back and watch this, just when you're watching the movie, just because of the present day that we're in, nobody really has a cell phone in this movie. Nobody's communicating by text message. It's just a different time in the late 90s where, you know, even Kevin Costner's writing messages on a baseball in the movie instead of sending a text or an email. So social media was not as big a deal to get the word out about a movie on the different forms of social media that we have. You did rely on word of mouth. You did rely on star power. So Costner's obviously the megastar, very successful, Dances with Wolves, right, earlier in the decade. You know, I was watching one of his recent ones, No Way Out, which we may have to do. We've seen that on that one from the late 80s. Great spy, dramatic thriller. With
amazing twist.
Amazing twist at the end. So you watch that one, and it's really different phases of Costner because in the 80s, Bull Durham, yes. No Way Out, yes. Then you go into the 90s, Dances with Wolves. You had Waterworld, which was the mess, but you had this one, and then he progresses on into the 2000s with a bunch of different
movies.
He
had a good little run. Let me interrupt you real quick. He had a good little run when you mentioned Dances with Wolves, but he had Robin Hood, which was huge, JFK, which was huge, The Bodyguard, which we did in a recent episode, which was huge. You know, he had a nice little 4 or 5 year run there, you know, especially maybe even longer than that if you want to throw Bull Durham and No Way Out in, and even The Untouchables. You know, he was an amazing movie star. He kind of gave people what they wanted. I know we've done a couple of Costners. I know we did The Bodyguard. Now, do you have a favorite Costner movie? I don't know if I've ever asked you that.
I believe we talked about this on The Bodyguard episode, and it's tough for me, but Tin Cup, yes, and maybe Bull Durham on those just because I'm such a big sports guy. But No Way – I can't pick one. I'm being a politician. No Way Out, love it. I love Well After This – him in Open Range with Robert Duvall where they're the ranchers. I love him later on in The Guardian as the flawed character, the Coast Guard trainer for Ashton Kutcher's character, training them how to be Coast Guard life-saving members of the Coast Guard aquatic team, essentially, and the paramedics and the rescue team. He's a flawed character in that. I love him in like 6 or 7 things. I can't pick one. For Costner, and he's definitely really good in this, and I love this one. I'm looking forward to talking more about it a little more in depth here in a few moments. But Costner is obviously the star. And what about Kelly Preston playing the female lead as Jane? We know her from numerous things. I mean, number one, she's obviously been in several different things, and recently before this, she had been in Jerry Maguire as the female lead, playing a strong
Avery.
Character. As Avery, she is she works for one of the teams, right, or works for the NFL. And she's
she was his girlfriend at the beginning, and she broke up with him when he wrote the mission statement.
And so he writes the mission statement and ruins his career, and she keeps referring to him as a loser with the L on the head as Avery. So, yeah, she's been in a bunch of different stuff.
Twins.
And before this, Twins.
She was amazing in Twins.
She was with Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito in Twins. So Kelly Preston works for me as the female lead. In this one.
And I really like, there's a couple guys I want to mention real quick that I really like. I thought J.K. Simmons did a great job as the manager, Frank Perry.
Yes.
And I really liked John C. Reilly as the catcher. There's a couple moments that John C. Reilly has in this one where after the way the movie starts, after he gets a couple of pieces of really bad news, he kind of looks up to him and goes, "This just ain't your day, Billy." You know, which is it's so perfect for the part. You know, he gets it right. And then I also like, we'll get into this later, but I want to mention this part when Billy actually catches on to the fact that he's throwing a perfect game, and he asks Gus, "Has anybody been on base yet?" And the look on his face just lights up. He's like, "Nope."
Yeah, and there's reasons, and there's reasons why for that. Obviously, yes, because
of
baseball taboo and jinxing a perfect game or a no hitter. There's all that kind of stuff in and around the movie. And you mentioned John C. Reilly. We talked on Days of Thunder recently on We've Seen That, and a reminder to go back and listen in our catalog. We recently did Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise and Robert Duvall. Speaking of Duvall and the NASCAR movie, Randy Quaid in it, Nicole Kidman, obviously, from 1990, but John C. Reilly in it as Buck. There's a little bit of Buck in there. I love the Southern accent. I love when he's around Will Ferrell as well with Ricky and Cal. Shake and Bake from Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. And John C. Reilly in some other serious movies, but he's also recently in the animated Wreck-It Ralph movies, including Ralph Breaks the Internet that has recently come out at the end of 2018. Saw that one in the theater recently with my now 10-year-old twins at the time that we're taping. But love John C. Reilly. He works as Gus, the catcher, and is an integral part to how this is all going to unfold. And you mentioned J.K. Simmons, who's had some decorated roles as of late. He's really had a long and distinguished career. I'm a big fan of his because I was a big fan of the television show The Closer, the adult drama, the weekly drama on TNT, The Closer, where he's Chief Pope. But he's done a lot of different things in and around that. He was in the Spider-Man movies one time. He was he's played some dramatic roles. He's in a new dramatic series, I think, on is it on Netflix or is it on Cinemax?
I believe it's on Stars.
It's on Stars.
Correct. I believe it's Stars.
And so that new series is like an extraterrestrial, futuristic one where there's alien replacements, right, for humans, and you've got your double that's out there somewhere that's doubling you somehow, some way, something like that with J.K. Simmons. But whenever
he also won an Oscar, I want to mention, for Whiplash.
A couple years back.
So
a long, decorated career that really in the 1990s we didn't know a lot about him. I just, when I look at him, I go, there's Chief Pope, because I watched The Closer for so many years. Chief Pope with a mustache playing the baseball manager here of the Detroit Tigers as Frank Perry at the end of the Tigers series.
And don't forget, for us, you know, he's on the Farmers Insurance commercials with Ricky Fowler.
We are farmers. We've seen that. We've covered that. Love him off of those. So, all right, so we've got the cast that sets this into motion, and let's get into the plot. Go ahead, get into the plot of what we have with Billy Chappell and the reason why it's for the love of the game.
Well, here's the deal. Billy Chappell is essentially like a Nolan Ryan type. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Except if Nolan Ryan played his entire career with one team, because he's been with the Tigers for 19 years. And the movie essentially is him reflecting on his life in baseball and his relationship with Jane, played by Kelly Preston. And it's a really entertaining way of looking at it, because the movie starts out with the Tigers going to play the Yankees. It's the end of a bad season for the Tigers. You know, nothing's going to happen. The Yankees are one win away from clinching. And ironically, the Yankees in the late 90s were winning World Series, so they would have had this thing clinched long before. But, you know, for the movie's purposes, they're getting close to clinching. And so the Tigers are going to pitch in Billy Chappell, and, of course, the game, for competitive purposes, they need to show up and play because the Red Sox are technically still in it, right? And we find that out by virtue of the announcers, Vin Scully and Steve Lyons. They kind of set the scene for us, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so Billy Chappell is going to pitch at iconic Yankee Stadium. And the morning of, he is visited by the owner of the Detroit Tigers, who is played by Brian Cox. And his name's Gary Wheeler. And he tells him that he is going to sell the Tigers. He said, it's one of those rumors that everybody pretty much knows is true, but I'm telling you it's true. And Costner's a little hungover because he had hoped to see his pseudo-girlfriend, off and on girlfriend, Jane, had hoped to see her the night before, and she didn't show up. So the liquor that he had gotten in the dinner he'd planned, he basically drank it all himself. So he's got a little bit of a headache. While Gary Wheeler's telling him, yes, I'm selling the team, and the bad news is that the group I'm selling it to never mentioned this at all during negotiations, but they want to trade you to the San Francisco Giants.
Wow.
So that's how his day starts out.
I was going to say, we have a lot of heavy things going on at the beginning here when we're introduced to Chappell. I mean, we've begun the movie with essentially it's like a home movie recap of his early life and becoming a baseball star. And it's setting the table for he's near the end of his career, almost at the end of his career. Great career, Hall of Fame career, won a World Series, hero, but he's at the end. And it's a bad season, as you mentioned. And so we know something is wrong with the girlfriend. We haven't met Jane yet. We haven't met Kelly Preston yet to know what's going on. And now the owner of the team, Brian Cox, who, again, when I look at this, I think of the dirty section chief from the CIA movie with Jason Bourne, the Bourne movies, Ward Abbott. I think of him when I see that. He's been in a bunch of different roles. And for the longest time, I didn't realize or remember, Jay Betzel, that Brian Cox, the actor, is Scottish with a Scottish accent. But he pulls off the American accent in so many movies, you don't realize that until you read his bio or you see him in other things where he has the Scottish accent. But he comes in as the owner, and he's dropping a bomb, a figurative bomb, on Costner's character, Chapel, that not only is this the end of our season, but I'm selling the team, and you're not even going to be a Tiger anymore. They want to trade you to San Francisco. This is going to be your last game with the only team that you've ever played for. So you got a lot of
the
heavy
life as
stuff.
You know it is over. Is
yes, you got a lot of heavy stuff. Let me just lay this on you before you have to go pitch this game later today. There's a lot. Yes.
Well, and we also have, you know, the fact that, you know, he was hoping to meet Jane, you know, and Kelly Preston's character, and never heard from her, and she actually calls the room while he's having the meeting with Mr. Wheeler, and she's downstairs in the lobby. So he cuts the meeting short, you know, and Mr. Wheeler has said, "I don't like the game anymore. The game stinks. You got free agency, you got arbitration, all the stuff that, you know, a lot of it gets very sports intensive. So the guys watching it'll like this kind of part, 'cause it's a little behind the scenes of Major League Baseball." And he's leaving the room. He stops and says, "It's not the game that stinks. You know, the game is still great." He runs downstairs to try and catch her. She leaves the lobby. He ends up finding her in Central Park. Kind of sitting there, and she's got some tears on her face, finds out that she is moving to London. And he had kind of hoped that they could reconcile. You know, he knows his career is coming close to being over. He hadn't, like, kind of like what we're going through here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex with Dirk Nowitzki. Is he going to retire? Is he not going to retire? It's kind of one of those things I have a feeling, you know, that he's definitely thought about hanging him up, but he hadn't decided, "Yes, for sure, I'm quitting."
Let me interject. But, so if you don't follow the NBA, Nowitzki is a very famous player in professional basketball. Because you and I often assume that everybody's a big sports fan that listens to us. They listen to us for movies and for different reasons. And obviously, this is a sports movie and a love story. But Nowitzki's a very famous basketball player in the NBA. Very famous. He is as big a star in terms of a non-Dallas Cowboy as there is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, right? And he may be about to play his final few games this season, may come back from one more season. That's the point you're making, right?
Correct. He's fresh on my mind because he's in year 21, all with the same team, just like Billy Chappell. Tonight, the night after we do this, he's going to break Wilt Chamberlain's record to move up to sixth all-time in NBA scoring. So he's a legendary type player, kind of like Billy Chappell is in For Love of the Game. So Billy Chappell finds out that his girlfriend that he was hoping to connect back with is moving to London. He finds out that if he wants to keep playing baseball, he's going to get traded to the San Francisco Giants. So it's one of those things, like I said earlier, when I kind of mentioned Gus. So he shows up at the ballpark, and him and Gus are talking about it, you know, and obviously no one else knows. And Gus mentions, yeah, no one knows, otherwise they'd be talking about it. You know, Chappell is showed up. He's late to the game. On his way to the clubhouse, he runs into this kid who turns out is the son of one of his former teammates, mm-hmm. You know, which kind of reminds you that, oh, my gosh, I really am that old. And this kid got called up that day to play for the Yankees. Ken Stroud's his name, and he'll figure into the game later on. But, you know, they're sitting there. There's a little kid, like a teenager, sitting in the clubhouse because Mr. Wheeler wants to find out if Billy is going to retire or not. He wants to tell the guys that are buying the team. Really, he wants to tell them so he can, you know, kind of shove it in their face because they had this big plan to trade him. So that's when Gus utters that line I mentioned earlier, "Billy, this is your day." And, you know, so kind of, as I said, there's a lot of things kind of intertwined. So while this is going on, while Billy's at Yankee Stadium, you know, you've got Kelly Preston. Jane is at the airport because she's leaving to go to London. Of course, her flight's delayed because that's how the movies go. And they have a little mechanical issue, so they don't have a little bit of a crash. She's sitting in the bar, and they have the game on, you know, next to one of the most obnoxious Yankees fans of all time, right? Can we agree on that?
Right. Well, most
the Yankee
of them,
fan in the bar played by Larry Joshua.
Larry Joshua is most Yankee fans, and most of them, I won't say all of them, most of them are over the top because they win all the time. And the expectation is we're going to win everything all the time. We're better than you. The New York sports fans are definitely passionate, but they're probably the most passionate about the Yankees because the Yankees are the most successful of all the New York teams. They've won more championships, more than double the championships than all the other teams combined. So Yankee fans are just over the top this way. And I thought Larry Joshua is great in portraying that. For example, we get this time of year, at the time that we're taping, a ton of New Yorkers, New Jerseyans, if I said that the right way, people that are from the New York, New Jersey area that come down to where I live in the Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater area to be around Yankee spring training, to be here to get out of the cold, to be here for spring break, to be here to be part of being in Florida for 6 months. We call them snowbirds. They're here, they're around, and for every five of them that you run into, four of them are Yankee fans, Jay. And three to four of them are like the character that Larry Joshua is playing. They are that over the top, that into it because of how successful the Yankees are. So he nails it with his portrayal. He's obnoxious. The Yankees have to win this game to clinch. It's like an expectation, okay, we are going to win this game. Chappell's kind of over the hill at the end of his career for the Tigers. We're going to win. And that just kind of plays into the whole back and forth that he's going to have with Jane, with Kelly Preston's character, with everybody else in the airport. There's so many different subplots intertwined here, and that's just another one of them at the airport.
Well, you mentioned the Yankee fans. Have you seen the game at Old Yankee Stadium?
I did not see. Yeah, actually, you know what I did? Now that you pop quiz me, about 2 years after this, I did get the chance on a press junket with my wife to see a game at Old Yankee Stadium in 2001, 2 years after this was made. And I have not been in the new Yankee Stadium as of yet, although I know people that have. Now, what about you? You ever been to Yankee Stadium?
I did. And my brother and I actually made a trip up there specifically to go before they tore it down because we just wanted to see it. We visited Shea Stadium, U.S. Open Tennis. We did the whole touristy thing in New York. But we went on a Monday afternoon to see them play. It was the first year that A-Rod was there. And it was the Monday following the series they'd had with the Red Sox. If you may remember this, where A-Rod got hit by a pitch.
Yes.
He's walking down the first baseline, and him and Jason Veritek got into a little shoving match where he kind of slapped him or whatever. I don't know if I'm describing it right, because it's been a long time since I saw it, but he actually ended up getting thrown out of the game and stuff, and there was a lot of talk that he was going to get suspended.
Benches emptied, and then,
right.
And then this is the famous incident where Don Zimmer went, and because Pedro Martinez, the famous Red Sox pitcher, was yapping at all the Yankees, and Zimmer went to take him on, and Pedro grabbed him like a bull coming at him and like a matador getting out of the way. He grabbed him all in one motion and threw him to the ground, and then that incensed everybody once that went everywhere on video. That's the Yankees' hatred for the Red Sox when you were in and around. So that
I remember Pedro Martinez.
That had just happened. That had just
happened. I didn't know if it was the same game or not. But
right.
Yeah.
So that had just happened.
Yeah, I didn't
days
know if it was
before?
All the same. Right, it happened like the Saturday,
wow.
And we went on Monday.
Wow.
And so we're seeing them play the Blue Jays. And, you know, you mentioned that we have the Texas Rangers here in Fort Worth, in Arlington, near the Fort Worth where I live. You go to the Ranger games, just kind of relaxed, you know, every now and then there'll be something big. But, you know, we had a good little run there about 7-8 years ago. For the most part, you know, they're 500 or less most years. Going to the game is something to do. When I went up there, Carlos Delgado was playing for the Blue Jays. And he refused to come out of the dugout for the seventh inning for God Bless America. And the Yankee fans were letting him have it. They were calling him things that I wouldn't call my worst enemies and probably things you would not want your daughters to repeat. And they're throwing batteries and stuff at him. And stuff that, I mean, I couldn't
it's
imagine.
It's crazy.
It was just unreal. And I was really glad I got to experience it because until you've been or unless you got to go to the old stadium, then it's hard really to describe what this was like. But when I watched this movie, you know, and you hear the fans yapping at him when he's out there on the mound, it harkens back memories to that day because it was a fun day. They won. They had Jeter, A-Rod, Kenny Lofton, Gary Sheffield. It was right around the time when we went, and it was a lot of fun.
And you aptly put it. I mean, they will throw things. They will yell things. It is a different atmosphere. But, again, they've won all the time. And that's the Yankees, and that's a great backdrop here. I mean, Costner and the movie makers here that were involved in this, they understood that. I mean, it's Costner's film, basically. They understood the backdrop needs to be Yankee Stadium. I mean, it doesn't work the same way if the Tigers are playing, the Kansas City Royals for the final game, or the Minnesota
the
Twins, or the Brewers, or the Seattle Mariners. It works because it's Yankee Stadium. It's a cathedral. It's the Yankees. The Yankees are trying to clinch. And the Tigers are trying to stop them with the aging pitcher trying to be the one that stops them in this second-to-last game of the season. So, it sets
sports-wise, let me ask you this. Yeah. Are you surprised they made Costner a Tiger and not a Yankee? I'm kind of surprised Steinbrenner let the Yankees lose.
I think that it works because Detroit's got a famed team. They've won championships in the past. They had won a championship in the 1980s in baseball. So people that are our contemporaries, that are our age, if you were in your 20s, 30s, 40s, it's not unrealistic to have the Tigers be that contending team if you followed Major League Baseball. So I think it works better that it's not the expected Yankees, the hated Yankees. He's not pitching for the Yankees. He's not pitching for the Red Sox or the Dodgers or the Cubs, the most famed teams, arguably. I think it works better that he's not with one of those. Agreed or disagree?
No, I like it. I agree. I was just surprised that Steinbrenner would allow that, you know, the fact that because he was obviously still around, George Steinbrenner, the, a.k.a. the boss. But so kind of back to the movie, we're at Yankee Stadium, and he does this really cool thing when he's out on the mound where he says, was it release the mechanism?
Yes.
And he literally basically is like push the mute button on your remote control, right? He can't hear anything. All those guys screaming about how what a bum he is and how he should retire and everything. And the whole – it's real blurry. It's kind of like you put like a bubble over the audience, if you will, the fans. And it's really cool. And a lot of the movie basically as the movie goes on, you know, at the beginning the manager, Frank Perry, had told Billy, hey, I'm going to start a different guy catcher because we need somebody that can hit. You know, and of course, Gus ends up getting the first hit of the game. There's a lot of fun little stuff there. You've got you know, Costner out there, and he's got his kind of little he has his real running commentary of the game where he's talking about Sam Tuttle, the third baseman for the other team, who he can't stand, and he throws at him. You know, basically, that's kind of the way Steve Lyons is the color guy on this, and he mentions that's how you know he's got his good stuff, because he can throw it and he knows right where it's going. You know, they have another one, a player for the Yankees, Davis Birch, who basically became too high-priced for the Tigers and ended up being traded to the Yankees. I believe Vince Scully says something along the lines of the beleaguered franchise in Detroit couldn't meet his monetary demands, and the Yankees were waiting with open arms and an open wallet.
Exactly, and we know this to be the case because that's why the owner is selling the team, because he's having financial problems, Gary Wheeler. And so and that would be the same reason why they're auctioning off Billy Chappell at the end of his career here, is they don't have the money to be able to compete with the big bad Yankees or the Red Sox or the top teams that are willing to spend whatever they're going to spend. So, yeah, you mentioned, I mean, along the way, breadcrumbs, whatever metaphor you want to use, clues, there's all kinds of things that are going to come in to the story, like when J.K. Simmons, as Perry, the manager, is talking to him in the bullpen before the game starts and says, I want to start the young catcher, and he basically says to him, you're starting Gus or I'm not pitching here in this last game. You know, I he's now saying, well, you're telling me how to manage a team. He's saying, I'm telling you this one time, it's Gus and me. And that's the relationship they have, because Gus understands too that Chappell's at the end of his career. He's hurting, because remember at the beginning of the movie, he sees Billy wince when he's putting his luggage in the overhead bin at the on the airplane. And for a pitcher, again, for our non-hardcore sports fans, for a pitcher, when your shoulder, your elbow, or whatever is bothering you, you're going to have to deal with some of that if you are a pitcher. It's always a constant battle for how much of it can you deal with, how much is it going to affect how you pitch. And Gus, in a way, is kind of like a caretaker for Billy Chappell. John C. Reilly is a caretaker for Costner, and obviously has been, not only on the baseball field, but in his personal life too. He's kind of a confidant. All of that, he's looking after him. And so now in this moment, Chappell is looking out for Gus.
He has a great line. Remember, he says, I've got the ugliest wife in the league.
Exactly.
You know, which is perfectly
meaning Gus. Meaning Gus.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Gus is looking after him and, you know, cleaning up after him after he had so much to drink the night before he's going to pitch this final game. So in this case, Chappell is looking out for Gus. I want Gus to be out there with him, with me. I need Gus in order to be successful. A lot of major league pitchers, they want the same catcher. They get into a routine and a rhythm with the same catcher that knows them well. And we see examples of that throughout the movie, where there's even a part of this later on where they're having this battle where Gus can sense there's something wrong. And he's looking at him, Chappy, you okay? And he's like, stay there. He's like, yeah, like a married couple, like a married couple going at it. I'm fine. Leave me alone. Stay there. And then, you know, eventually they do come out and check him. And Costner even says, Chappell even says, it hurts. But if it hurts too much, then I'll let you know. And then I'll come out. I want to finish this. But part of that is he's pitching really well. He's got a shutout going. It's not like he's given up a lot of runs and there's a reason to take him out. He's lobbying hard, even though his arm hurts. I love the fact he stood up for Gus. Gus is going to protect him. And then, of course, it's intertwined. You made mention of it real quick that Gus becomes an integral part of the game and the actual game and the attempt to pitch a perfect game as it goes along.
Well, and remember at the opening in the bottom of the first inning, when the Yankees are coming up, Coster's out there warming up, and he just fires one in, and Gus comes out, and he goes, "Hey, you got to warn me. You almost took my hand off." And he just glares at him. "I'm going to throw a little harder tonight. There's your warning." You know, they've got that kind of relationship, and it's really cool to just see how it plays out throughout the game, because basically, you know, while he's out there pitching, you've got the baseball action. You know, the hardcore sports fans are probably loving it, you know, because as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of behind the scenes of what it'd be like to be a major league pitcher pitching at Yankee Stadium, you know. And then when he's sitting in the dugout, Gus is always the one that's closest to him, although the further they get into this perfect game, there's fewer of them sitting next to him, as you can see, because nobody wants to take him out of his zone.
There you go. There's another thing, too, that's part of that. We'll go ahead and talk about it right here. It's a superstition in baseball that if a guy gets to about the fifth inning and has not allowed a hit, you start ignoring him. Again, for the non-hardcore, I'm not trying to be arrogant about this. I'm just assuming that not everybody that's listening to us, Jay, on We've Seen That, knows all of the different nuances in sports that we do. So in baseball, the superstition is if you have a no-hitter going, where the other team doesn't have a hit, much less a perfect game, where nobody's been on base, where you've faced 12 batters in four innings and gotten them all out, or 15 batters in five innings and getting them all out, they're going to start not talking to you. They are going to leave you alone, and it's like taboo, Jay, for anybody to start coming to talk to you, sit by you, or say anything. It's like an unwritten rule. Ignore it.
When they don't say anything to each other, they literally don't.
Right,
mention it.
Right. It's almost like if you talk, jinx. You're going to curse this or jinx this, and so that's a neat part of the movie, but it's interesting for later on, because obviously Gus is still talking to him and Gus is checking on him, and that's going to be the big part where Costner makes mention of the perfect game in progress. But I think it's really true, and of course, as you mentioned, the baseball part of the movie works, and you keep going back and forth to the love story with Jane. So for the fans that aren't just the baseball fans, we see how he meets Jane, we see how the relationship develops with Jane, right?
Right, and it shows, you know, at one point, you know, when the owner of the Tigers came to visit him at the hotel, he joked with him that he can't remember all of his aliases, and he pats him, and he's like, "Price of fame, huh?" You know, and then it shows when he goes to pick Jane up, when he meets Jane originally, he's driving, he's got a little Porsche 911, he'd obviously gone to play golf, and he sees her on the side of the road kicking her car, and stops to talk to her, and whenever the tow truck driver gets there, the tow truck driver is like a little boy. He's all excited. "Oh my God, you're Billy Chappell. You're the greatest ball player ever." You know, and so you can kind of see how
Doesn't follow baseball, doesn't know who he is. She lives in New York. The Tigers are in New York playing a series a few years earlier. And so, he's on an off day for him where he's not pitching. He's gone to play golf. It's a random meeting. She's a good looking woman. He wants to help her with her car. She has no clue who he is. But the tow truck
guy. It's a game day. Remember, he's on his way to work, because that's what he says. "I love to sit here and talk to you,
right?
But I got to go to work. Would you like to go to the game with me?" And the tow truck driver says, "If she don't want to go, I'll go." And he's like, "Don't let that happen."
That's right. It's not an off day for him pitching. He is pitching that night, and she's going to end up sitting in the friends and family box
with all the wives,
and she doesn't have any idea what she's about to walk into with
no
all
clue.
The wags, all the wives and the girlfriends that are, and all the friends and family that are going to be in that box. But it's interesting how they weave back and forth the story of Billy and Jane in and around him pitching the perfect game, because you're learning about their relationship, how it started. She is obviously very leery of any relationship with a guy. She even expresses to him she doesn't want to get her heart broken.
Calls herself a groupie a couple times, and basically makes him mad. He's like, "I didn't like it the first time. Now it's starting to piss me off."
Right.
You know, I didn't treat you like a groupie. You don't look anything like – you don't act like a groupie. That's not what this is. I believe I've been a perfect gentleman. And at the beginning when they're talking in Central Park, Jane and Billy, she mentions 5 years ago when I met you, ... So you know that these flashbacks are over the past 5 years. And you kind of get to know Costner a little bit better. You know, the two of them have this agreement that, you know, when we're together, we see each other great. Otherwise, we'll live our own lives. He, of course, takes that literally and ends up hooking up with his masseuse when she comes to visit down in spring training. You know, there's a few things like that over time. You know, they'll get into fights. They'll come back together for whatever reason. Like, you know, at one point, Kelly Preston had not mentioned to him that she has a daughter, but she calls him when he's in Boston. And all of it kind of – it's basically the game itself intertwined, because there's the outfielder Mickey Hart for the Tigers who had the ball bounce off his head and go over the fence, similar to Jose Canseco's deal here in Texas, where the ball hit him in the head and bounced out for a home run. And so he's kind of thinking back to that when they see Mickey up to bat. And it kind of he starts thinking back to the night when that thing happened with Mickey. And that's when he got the call from Jane. This says, my daughter ran away from home. She went to see your dad. She's in Boston. He's not there. And he didn't even know she had a daughter. That was the introduction. And he says, what's your name? And she goes, Freedom. And he's like, what? And she's like, I'm just kidding. It's Heather. You know, so, I mean, they still, even when they hadn't seen each other in a while, they still have that little repartee going between the two of them. So he.
So
he
I love the, that scene, ahead. Though, when they're on the plane with Jane's daughter.
Well, first, let me digress. When they go to pick her up and they got the team bus and she walks out and sees the team down there.
It's the Tigers team got, bus, right?
Yeah, you got J.K. Simmons as the manager out there, you know, standing in the street in this horrible neighborhood. And he goes, let's get out of here before we got our ass kicked twice in one night. You know, there's so many just fun parts to this. And, yeah, so they're on the plane, like you mentioned, where the guys are all trying to guess their age, I guess.
Well, right, and he's looking at her, and she starts explaining the whole dynamic of a mother-daughter, teenage daughter that don't get along, and you can tell that Chappell, he's like regretting that he even asked about this. I didn't really want this, but I'm doing this for Jane. But then you start to see he cares. He cares about the daughter, and that's going to play a role for later on at the very end of the movie. He cares for Jane and Jane's relationship with the daughter because she keeps explaining to him, I had her very young. I was only 16 years old. I was
correct.
16 and I had a daughter. So we're finding out all these things that, again, tug at you for the love interest of this, whether you're a man or a woman watching this movie. But I love that scene on the plane because the expressions on Costner's face without saying anything, I've already kind of started – a little of that with my daughters, or I try to. I'm kind of like, I didn't bargain for the 3-minute explanation of why this is such a problem with whatever it is, but you just got to tolerate it. You got to listen. This is part of going through raising a daughter, having a teenage daughter, and the drama and all of that. And it is kind of interesting that later on, as they're flashing back and forth, progressing from when he first met her, she's on the daughter. She's on the Billy Chappell train here on his side on a lot of things, and he's taking her side. And she's kind of wanting his advice and seeking his counsel and, you know, looking for a fatherly type figure, even though they aren't married. So I really like that. And I like how that works in this case with Jenna Malone, the actress playing Heather.
Well, you know, she mentions that her father doesn't care anything. She can go do whatever she wants. And she also mentions that her mother is very protective because her mother never had the love story, which is a huge thing for this movie because that kind of explains part of, you know, why Jane is so apprehensive with Billy. You know, yes, while they were quote unquote just, you know, talking or whatever, she did go down there after he invited her and she said no and surprised him and, you know, kind of catch him cheating on her. But for the most part, you know, you've got facts. The two of them are standing outside the hotel talking and he gets interrupted 3 or 4 different times. People wanting autographs. You know, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that the movie nails so well, the behind the scenes of what these celebrities and athletes have to deal with. They can't, you know, you and I, if we're talking to a girl outside a restaurant, we're good. We don't get interrupted
exactly.
with people wanting our picture and stuff. But, you know, you've got that. So while we're thinking, how could she not love this guy? This guy's rich. He's famous. He's cool. You know, but in the back of her mind, she's like, you know, I'm just going to get burned because that she's fully expecting it no matter what. Right. So kind of moving on, you've got them where she finally gives in. You know, he says, I'd like to spend time with you and Heather. They go to the mountains, which was that scene where they're up in the mountains was actually filmed in my former hometown of Aspen.
How about
by the way,
that?
fun fact, by God.
Now, you shared with us previously that you've had brushes with greatness in Aspen. And so did you see any of the areas that you used to be around, live around in the movie? And it clicked immediately because this is around the time that you had been in Aspen, right around there, right?
Yeah, this movie came out when I was in Aspen. Actually, it came
that?
Out. Sorry, it. I moved to Aspen like that December, and this movie came out in September.
How
so it came
that?
Out right before I went. But anyways, no, I did not. I mean, I didn't see
when
anything.
You
There's
watch
nothing
it
particularly
now,
stands out. No, I actually looked for it last night, and I didn't see
interesting.
Anything.
Interesting. In watching the movie again, I'm just wondering if okay, you know where this is or where that is with how they're portraying it. But I mean, clearly, he's trying to make the relationship with Jane work. Even though they have obvious obstacles between them, that she lives in New York, he's a traveling Major League Baseball player who lives in Detroit, they aren't married, but they're trying to make it work, and they're spending the winters together somewhere here where they're trying to make their relationship work. That's the point.
Right. And this, the part when they cut to them in Aspen is, you know, it's one of the times between innings, just the top of the inning when the Tigers are up to bat and he's on the dugout. Or he's in the dugout, you know, with the jacket on his shoulder to keep his arm warm. And he looks down his hand and he sees a scar between his thumb and his pointer finger, right? Mm-hmm. And so he kind of does a little flashback to when that happened and he's working out in the garage and he slices his hand. You know, Jane rushes him to the hospital and, you know, he's losing blood and it's really intense and really well-made part of the movie. And, you know, she's there. She takes care of him. She's got it. She gets him to the hospital. When she gets there, since they're not married, the people at the hospital won't let her in to see what's going on, you know. And in the meantime, he's kind of in and out of what's going on, you know. And he tells her, you need to call Mike Udall with the Tigers. He's the most important person for me right now, which, of course, breaks her heart because she had his back. One for him, who knows, or for her, who knows what would happen, right? And so, of course, that crushes her. And, of course, that throws him into a complete loop because, you know, his life that he's known of being this dominant pitcher, you know, the best pitcher in baseball, basically, could very well be over. He can't even, you know, when he's doing spring training with the pitching coach, the pitching coach says something about, you know, touch the seams. Like, I can't even feel him, you know, and he's just having all kinds of problems. He's snapping at everybody. He's real short. He's stressed out. You name it. Every possible thing, you know, that he could be going through this a ton of emotions. And the last thing on his mind really is his relationship with Jane, partly because he takes her for granted, right? And so basically you kind of find out that there's like a 5 or 6 month period where they only talk like on the phone like 3 times. And he's in town to play and he shows up at like a museum or like an art gallery type thing.
Yep.
And he sees her. Her hair's completely different. It's like shorter and straighter. She's actually on a date with someone else who's one of her editors that he remembered, Ian the editor. And, you know, she's smoking cigarettes. She's nothing like the Jane that we've known pretty much throughout. She basically says, I'm with someone else. You surprised me. I wasn't ready for this.
At this point, Famous Jay, can you blame her? Because at every opportunity where she's given everything trying to be with him, I mean, she's the one driving him to the hospital while his hand is bleeding, in her pajamas, by the way, with a coat on, trying to help save him while they're in this vacation home. She's trying every way that she can to have some kind of a relationship, and he's repeatedly, I don't want to say pushing her away, but at least keeping her at a distance of, I still want to be a ball player, we aren't married, I'll see you when I see you, and maybe it's love, maybe it's not. And so I can't blame her, really, from her standpoint, that she wants to move on and wants something else. And that, again, adds to the subplot here that we're learning about while we're going back and forth to the baseball game in the present to the past. It didn't surprise me that she's looking to move on.
Yeah, while he was down there, you know, working with spring training coaches and stuff, trying to figure this out, you know, she was there with him, trying to help him, driving him places, cooking him food. And he snapped at her and told her, he's like, I want you to leave. I don't want anybody here with me. You know, I mean, so no, I don't blame her in the least, to answer your question. I mean, you can see it from both ends because you could see what he was going through on his end and you can see what she's going through on her end. And it just wasn't the right time. You know, so much of climbing, you know, in this case, you know, they've gone through it multiple times over a 5-year period. It just wasn't the right time, you know. And so the further on we go, like I mentioned, Davis Birch earlier had left and gone to the Yankees, and that was his best friend on the team. And, you know, but that was kind of his Gus, I guess, back then. And it's just, it's one of those movies where it kind of tugs at your emotions too, because you want them to end up together. And part of it is you can understand it from both sides if they don't, you know, but at the same time, you're sitting there, you're rooting for him to get this perfect game and you're rooting for them to get together and you're like, you know, you want it to get there and you want to see what happens. And then, and they keep showing more flashbacks, which are different. And then you kind of come to modern day time where he's out in LA to play the Angels and he sees Heather, Jane's daughter. Yep. And she's going to USC and she's obviously much, you know, much older in it. She's played by Jenna Malone. I'm not sure we mentioned that earlier, but Jenna Malone comes over to him and she's like, hey, do you remember me? He's like, of course, you know, gives up, hugs her. They're talking, you know, he's like, how's your mom? She's like, oh, she's fine. And then her friends are like, Heather, let's go. So, you know, she hugs him again and you can tell this is genuine. She's like, I miss you. He's like, I miss you too. And you can, and so then he calls Jane that night, says, I'm going to be in town. I would like to see you. Do you have plans? And Jane says, no. He's like, how about dinner at 6 at the Waldorf? Cause that's where they had like their first date. Right. And she goes, how about 8 o'clock in your room? So it kind of gets us up to speed on where we are.
Yep. 'Cause
now, as we now know, she did not show up to his room at 8 o'clock. And part of the
there's a reason why, and that's what she's revealing early in the movie, that I'm breaking this off once and for all. I'm going to be gone for good. I'm leaving.
Yeah, there's no more of us.
And that's all weighing on him while he's trying to pitch this final game. And that, I mean, I love that. I love the intertwining of the story that, again, if we haven't conveyed it enough, and we've been talking for about 45 minutes now, to pitch a perfect game in baseball short of winning a world championship, being on a championship World Series team and having a ring, that's probably the most noteworthy thing that you can do in a Major League Baseball game. So few players get a chance to throw a perfect game as a pitcher. There's only been probably 20, 25 of them in the history of baseball and all the thousands and thousands and thousands of games that are played. So you've got all of these things intertwined, the love story, the back and forth of are they going to stay together or break up, and it's weighing on his mind while he's pitching for single game immortality and a perfect game. So, and that's why the for the love of the game intertwined in around a perfect baseball game, it just it works because the drama is building on can he get the final outs, and are they going to get together or is it over once and for all, and is maybe all of that going to weigh on his mind and cost him, and it's going to cost him his perfect game. Somebody's going to get a hit, somebody's going to get on base, and it's going to be over.
Well, part of the reason he has the perfect game is his mind is not there. His mind is on Jane, and so he doesn't have time to you know, dwell on it like what happened in a lot of games. And you mentioned that that it hadn't happened very often. It's happened 23 times ever.
Ever.
I did a little research for this because I planned on us mentioning this.
Ever.
As we do this in March of 2019, the last time it happened was August 15th, 2012, by, you want to guess?
I can't remember the 2012 one. I know a more distant one than that was Randy Johnson in the 2000s. I'm trying to remember 2012 who had the perfect game, and I don't have it off the top of my head.
King Felix Hernandez for the Seattle Mariners.
Was it against my Tampa Bay Rays?
It might have, I'm not
believe
positive.
It was.
When I wrote all this down.
That's the reason why I repressed the memory, because I think it came against the Rays, 27 up and 27 down. And again, we're not talking about just no-hitters, because a no-hitter is slightly
this
different.
Means nobody reached
nobody
base.
On base, 27 batters faced, 27 outs. And of course, hardcore baseball fans will remember the near-perfect game. What was it? I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. The pitcher for the Tigers that got to the 26 outs, I believe it was Armando Galarraga, not Andres Galarraga, the batter, but it was Galarraga, the pitcher, and he got 26 outs. And on the 27th out, it should have been the 27th out, but the umpire called the runner safe, and so it was ruled an infield hit that should have been the 27th out. So the Tigers were close to having a perfect game in real life. In the
when he got the next out, there's kind
was,
of a joke. They call that the 28
Armando,
out perfect game.
Armando Galarraga, right, is the pitcher
correct,
for the
Armando
Tigers
Galarraga.
That got 26 outs and almost pitched a perfect game after this movie. This is how elusive it is. Yes, there have been a bunch more no-hitters where a runner might have gotten on a walk or an error, but 27 up, 27 down, it's immortality. And you're right, his mind is everywhere, and maybe that's a good thing. And I think this is a good point to revisit what we talked about earlier just briefly, where Gus comes out there and Chappell breaks protocol, where he says what to Gus on the mound late in the game? Gus?
Well, you know, he's in pain. He's out there. He's kind of walking around the pitcher's mound, and he glances at the scoreboard, and he sees 0-0-0-0. And so Gus gets up and runs out there, and he turns around to him, and he's like, has anybody been on base? And Gus's face, like I said, it's like a kid at Christmas.
Uh-huh.
He smiles. It kind of lights up, and he's like, nope. And you, like I said, a sports fan, you'll get the chills. It was such a cool moment. And so then in his mind, he's like, he's in pain. He's like, I got to get six more outs. I got to do it. You know, he's never done this. You know, he mentioned what Gus says, this is new territory for me. And Billy says, me too. You know, at the beginning of the game with the Fox stats, when he was warming up, it showed he was 8-11 for the year was his record. So he had an under 500 record, but also did show that he had one complete game shutout. So he has gone the distance at least once this season. So it's there. He can do it. It's just a matter of it's a 1-0 game. You know, are they going to leave him in and give him the chance? If anyone gets on base, they're going to let him try and finish this game. You know, the manager has no clue the team's been sold and all these guys are out. You know, this the only people that know is the pitcher and the catcher, right?
Yeah, and so you have all of that as the backdrop for him trying to get the final outs here of a game that, again, doesn't have any bearing for the Tigers, but it has some bearing for the Yankees. They want to try to win the game. They try to get a bunt to get a single, and usually that's taboo, but this is a...
Oh, that's so wrong.
Yeah, but this is a 1-0 game, and see, I argue with people all the time, if you're trying to win the game, especially late in the season, and it's only a 1- or 2-run game, and you're trying to get on, it's okay to bunt. Again, the unwritten rules of baseball, not everybody's a huge baseball fan, is that you don't try to ruin somebody's no-hitter or perfect game with that, especially if it's 3-0, 4-0, 5-0, where that one individual base runner doesn't mean as much. But in a 1-0 game, you can totally see it. And so his adversary that he's going against there, that he's already gotten out a couple of times, is trying to bunt. And of course, Chappell has to make one of a couple of plays where he goes down on his knees and throws him out. I mean, that's a great moment. You talk about stand up and cheer in the theater moment where he throws the guy out.
Yeah.
That's a big moment to keep the perfect game alive and keep the storyline alive.
No, for sure. Yeah, he slides and kind of throws across his body. It was a great play. And it's funny, like, you know, while we've mentioned all these flashbacks with Jane, you know, in real time, she's at the airport watching this game, you know, and she's really emotional. She even misses her plane. Her plane's about to leave and she can't leave. She's got to stay and watch and see what happens, because she leaves the bar because she sees on his face, she knows he's in pain, and
right.
She can't bear to watch him lose this, right? So she leaves, going to the plane.
She knows what he's been through to rehab,
right,
just to get back. She knows, obviously, this is near the end of his career, if not the end of his career, because they've met and they've talked. And she knows this is, you know, she even says that to the bartender. She even says that this is, you know, I know what's going to happen here. He's hurting. He won't tell anybody that he's hurt. And this is going to end, you know, essentially this is going to end badly here. But she can't walk away from it. She can't go get on the plane. She has to see how it ends, because essentially she still loves him. And she's coming to grips with the fact she still loves him, and she doesn't really want to go to London without him. And so it works perfectly. And of course, you've got more obnoxious Yankee fans around the bar because there's now more interest that we've gone to the 8th inning. The dramatic music is playing in the movie. There's fans all over the gate at the airport that are watching the game and hanging on every play because they realize what's at stake. A perfect game is at stake, Jay.
Well, it's so cool because, you know, now this would just be on social media. Everybody would know about it. But here, these people are experiencing it, watching it, you know, and it's really neat that she's watching this game with a bunch of Yankee fans, and they're all rooting for the perfect game, other than that one guy at the bar who he still thinks that Ken Stroud's safe at the end in the last play. But, yeah, you've got the final inning when he comes out. He even kind of breaks his own protocol, and he starts talking to God. He's like, you know, God, I don't try to bother you with these things, 'cause I think you got more important things to worry about than baseball. But if you could just take this pain away from Arm for about 10 minutes, I'd really appreciate it. You know, and it's just, it's so epic because you've got, you know, Davis Birch almost hits a home run. He has a home run that gets taken away from him by Mickey Hart.
The player that had the ball bounce off his head. So that's a great Hollywood
moment. Correct,
would
be Mickey Hart.
Right.
The guy that he, yeah, and when he had the ball bounce off his head, he was saying, you know, he's talking to Costner in the locker room saying, oh, it's pretty funny, huh? And Costner says, there's a lot of things that SportsCenter shows I don't think is funny. He's like, don't let them make a joke out of you. Just walk right past the media out there, and next time we're here, I'll go out and work the wall with you together. You know, so he's so old school, and he's the kind of guy you'd love to have as a teammate. And it turns back around that here, the fact that he, you know, Mickey Hart's defense, and Mickey Hart's defense saves this perfect game because he goes up and gets the ball, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's what the drama is building. The great catch happens. The reactions of the people in the airport's great. Jane's reacting, and we see Heather is watching, like, in her college dorm room too, and she
telling her friends to shut up.
She realizes what's going on, because this is that one golden moment for a pitcher where he's got the realistic shot to get 27 up, 27 down, 27 outs in a perfect game. And so many times, there have been numerous times where a pitcher has taken a perfect game into the 9th inning only to have somebody rob it with a hit. There was a pitcher for the Seattle Mariners in the early 90s, probably 8 or 9 years before that. And I want to say the pitcher's name, I don't have it in front of me, was like Eric Nelson. And he gave up a home run to an Oakland A's player that later became part of a Seinfeld episode. Ken Phelps was the Oakland A's player who hit a home run off the Mariners pitcher with 2 outs in the 9th, 26 outs into a perfect game, and he gave up a home run on the 27th batter. So what I'm saying is, this thing is elusive. This thing, all the way down to the final pitch of the final out, can get away from you. And that, again, is building with the music and the drama of the movie. Can he finish off the perfect game?
Okay, so we're down to the final out. In your mind, do you think they're going to get it? Because I was still kind of wavering because I thought there's a chance he might not get the perfect game but still get the girl. What were you thinking when you saw it?
Exactly. There's always a Hollywood angle where something happens. I mean, perfect example in a baseball movie that we made reference to, and we should mention this to the audience. Go back and listen in our archive because last year, 2018, we did a similar kind of one before the start of the baseball season with Rob Dibble. The great Major League pitcher, won a World Series with the Reds, All-Star a couple of times in Major League Baseball, does a fantastic job on the radio. Remember Dibs from ESPN Radio with Dan Patrick, from Fox Sports Radio and Fox TV. Dibs now doing his own radio work in New England. He was on with his talking baseball movies. There's a lesser-known baseball movie called The Slugger's Wife, all right? The Slugger's Wife stars Michael O'Keefe from Caddyshack, one of our favorite movies. Rebecca De Mornay of Risky Business and a few other movies. She's the female lead. She is a pop star. She's not a baseball fan. It's kind of the same thing. So O'Keefe's character is trying to break the elusive Roger Maris 61 home run record in a baseball season for the Atlanta Braves. So I'll go ahead and I'll give the spoiler alert here because we did it before on the previous one that as part of the plot of the movie, his character breaks the record. But it's in the final game of the season and the Braves are trying to go to the postseason. So he breaks the record in the final game, but they lose the game dramatically. I think they're playing the Houston Astros and the Slugger's Wife. And so they lose the game to miss the playoffs, even though he's broken the record. And so the plot now becomes the season is over, even though he broke the record. And I still remember the reporter, and this was a great bit of screenwriting from the writers. The reporter asks him, does it take some of the edge off of breaking Roger Maris's record that you guys have lost the game and lost the pennant and the chance to go to the postseason? And he says it takes the edge, the sides, the middle, and all of it off of it. Because that's, I mean, it's Hollywood. So I lay that out, Jay, that something like that could be happening here on this final at bat and this final out where the perfect game is ruined, but it's okay because he and Kelly Preston end up getting back together anyway, and that's more important than a singular moment in a baseball game.
Right, and I actually left out a part, my apologies, everyone, in the top of the ninth. He's been thinking about this the whole game. He actually takes a baseball and signs it and says that I'm through for the love of the game and has Wheeler's nephew take it up to Wheeler so that he knows he's done. So this way the audience, too, knows that he's retiring. This is his last time to go out and ever
pitch. He will
pitch
not go to San
anywhere.
Francisco in the trade. Tell San Francisco, not, right. I'm through. You're selling the team. This is it. Nobody knows that again except for he and Gus and now the owner that this is going to be it. Jane probably has some idea that he's at the very end here, but it all works for the dramatic moment and for the last at bat.
Yeah,
right?
And essentially I think, you know, you may correct me on this, but I think it's because he had decided that she was more important than baseball and he's going to go find her in London.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that I think that's the reason he was quitting, not because he was not one to play anymore, but that she was more important, and it kind of dawned on him that –
and it's
on
so
this,
Hollywood.
This huge night,
she's
this
told
huge
him
night, that's what he's been thinking about.
Right, she's told him that day, that morning, I'm leaving for London tonight. I'm gone. I'm leaving. This is why I haven't talked to you. And so that's weighing on him while he's trying to get the 27 outs and the 27th out. It's total Hollywood. Total.
Yeah,
Hollywood.
So he goes out. So the last guy to come up to bat, there's two outs, and the last guy to come up to bat is Ken Stroud, the young player that we met earlier in the movie, whose father played with Kevin Costner. And he was a bat boy for the Tigers when he was a kid. And Steve Lyons mentions is what a great move it is by the Yankees manager because this young guy has no clue how big this situation is. He's just young enough and cocky enough to be able to come in and, you know, and the manager, who Bobby Mack is his name in the movie, but in real life he's Augie Garrido, who was,
see,
the,
I was gonna
the
maybe
manager
get you,
at UT.
I was going to get you maybe with a nugget, but you live in Texas, and Augie Garrido, very famous college baseball coach, very college baseball oriented figure. And so I remember seeing that and recognizing Augie Garrido right away when I watched this movie the first couple of times, that he's there as the Yankees manager. So that's neat. So Augie Garrido's character, the Yankees manager, is saying to the young kid, go get him.
Wreck it.
Go wreck the perfect game here. Go get a hit.
Right. And Augie Garrido, I just want to mention this, before he was at UT, was at Cal State Fullerton, and that is where Kevin Costner went.
There you go.
And so that's why that's kind of the tie in there, if you will.
And so we get the last.
Augie Garrido also passed away last year. I want to mention real quick. He passed away last spring.
How about
the late Augie Garrido?
And was such a beloved figure. Won College World Series plural at the University of Texas. so well known. So that sets up our final moment here of this movie for the perfect game and for the love story. So take us through it there, Famous Jay. Spoiler alert, everybody. So, here's how it ends.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, turn your dial down for a moment.
Or come back. So Ken Stroud, skip ahead in about 2 or 3 minutes while we're talking more about the critical acclaim of the movie and that kind of stuff. But
exactly.
For right now,
Ken,
for the rest
Ken Stroud
of you, go.
Hits one back up the middle. Chapel dives for it. It goes off his glove. Is it the shortstop that slides
total
in?
Total Hollywood.
It?
Total Hollywood,
yeah.
Right? The
slides
ball off of Chapel's
Ozzie
glove.
Smith style almost, yeah, behind second base.
Slides in the
over,
dirt,
gets it,
slow
jumps
motion.
Jumps up to his feet, throws him out, well out, a couple steps out. Game over. The Yankee fans even start cheering for him. The ones who've been dogging him out the whole time, they start cheering for him. It's a perfect game. Great job. You know, the team has him, you know, they're carrying him off. You know, he's just, you know, it's euphoria everywhere, basically, is probably the best way to put it. And you even have, you know, Vin Scully, who's calling the game in the movie, he mentions that he called the perfect game in the World Series at Yankee Stadium that Don Larsen pitched against the Brooklyn Dodgers.
That's right.
So I mean, so much of this, like I said, you've got stuff that just sports fans will love. And the funny part is in 1998, David Wells threw the second perfect game at Yankee Stadium. And in 1999, David Cone threw the third. So the very year this movie came out,
exactly,
there was a perfect game thrown. And even more ironic than that, the day David Cone threw the perfect game in 99, the ceremonial first pitch was Don Larsen to Yogi Berra.
How about that?
The catcher, the tandem from the 1956 perfect game.
Perfect
so
game
there's
mojo.
a lot of really cool stuff about it being at Yankee Stadium.
It is so elusive to throw one of these. You mentioned, what, 23 guys have ever done it. Two Yankees did it 2 years in a row at Yankee Stadium. And how about that timing that the second one was done just months before the movie was released in September? And the Yankees won the World Series, by the way, in 98 and 99 as well, at the height of their reestablishment as the Yankee dynasty when this movie was coming out. But it's total Hollywood there, as I was interjecting in the background, when it's in slow motion. I don't know how it was for you in the theater, but your heart kind of skips a beat if you're a sports fan of, oh no, is that ball going to roll through and be a base hit with two outs to ruin the perfect game? But the shortstop makes the great play, throws him out, and everybody goes bonkers. Cheering for Costner, cheering for Chapel, the character, because he has the perfect game. There's the Hollywood moment. They're carrying him off the field. You know, very ceremonial that it's his, you know, it's going to be his final game. What a way to end his career. Total Hollywood on that. I like it.
Yeah, I'm glad it had a happy ending there. And I was partly expecting it to be similar to the ending of Major League, where Tom Berenger's out there celebrating, getting the game-winning hit, and he looks over and sees Rene Russo there, you know, about to walk on the field and come out and you know, the two of them get together. But
yep,
in this one, it's not to be the case. He goes back to the hotel. He's got a drunk Gus with him. He tucks Gus away into bed, goes back to his suite, and there's no messages from Jane. Which, I mean, I guess it kind of adds a little realism to it. You've mentioned there's a lot of Hollywood in this, the way that all this stuff has worked out. But it is kind of realistic, the fact that he goes back to his hotel and she's not there waiting
it's
for
finality.
Him.
It's finality.
You know, nothing like that.
It's finality, right?
Yeah, and
he realizes she's gone. She is left.
The very night he throws a perfect game at Yankee Stadium, he's sitting in bed by himself crying because the love of his life is gone. So you cut to the next day. It's him walking through the airport, and he's going to London. He's got his bag packed. He's ready to go to London. He's out there looking at the plane. Turns around over his left shoulder, he sees Jane sitting there. And, of course, she saw him in the distance, and she knew there was nothing she could do because he was going to see her. And so that's the part where, you know, they lock eyes. He goes over. He even, at one point, you know, he mentions, I thought I had an entire ocean to think about what I was going to say to you. But essentially, she's saying that, you know, throughout the movie that he doesn't need her. He needs baseball. And she basically comes out and says that he's given his everything, his all to baseball and his all to life, but he didn't give his all to her. And he's ready to do that now. And he realizes that he did need her. And so that's where the happy ending comes from, that, you know, he's about to walk away because he said what he needed to say. And she reaches out and grabs his hand, and they basically embrace
Hollywood
in the middle of the airport.
Yep.
Not quite the Casablanca ending or whatever, but it is one where you know it's a happy ending, you know, for our characters, who both of them at times can be not the greatest of people throughout the movie, but it, you know, in the end they end up together.
Love conquers all, even after the perfect game. So it works, and then we fade to black and we have the credits. And I'm one for a good ending. This was a really good ending here because the sports fan is enthused by the perfect game. And then the romantics that are watching this, he finally ends up with the girl. I don't think the movie works as well if it ends somehow that they're not together at the end of it, that this has separated them once and for all. So, in some ways, maybe it was expected or almost sappy that, yeah, he's going to get back with her one way or the other, and he's going to get back with her even after the perfect game. But I do think it worked at the end. So yes, the movie for me works for those reasons. You want to go to the critics here on what they had to say?
Yes. Actually, I wanted to actually throw one more thing in sports-wise. You know, obviously with him retiring on a perfect game, can you think of anything in real life that would come close to that? The closest I could think of was John Elway retiring after the two Super Bowls.
Yep.
Or maybe Peyton Manning retiring after his. But that's retiring with a win. This is like personal glory. Can you think of anything like that?
Well, and keep in mind, those were for championships, as you're mentioning,
correct,
where you've been playing in the postseason. You're trying to win the title. We see that all the time in sports. I don't know. You think of boxers that go out on top, winning their final fight, finishing undefeated. You would have hoped that Muhammad Ali had done that back in the day, but he kept fighting and lost a couple of times at the very end.
Pete Sampras. Don't forget, Pete Sampras won the U.S. Open tennis and then never played again.
There you go.
After he'd
There's
been
a
down and out. He'd been losing second and first round of these spare tournaments and then beat Andre Agassi to win the U.S.
And
Open.
Maybe I want to see that from Serena Williams, who's arguably the greatest female tennis player ever, certainly of the modern era of the last 15 or 20 years, win one more major, the U.S. Open, Wimbledon, and then walk away and say, that's my final moment. I'm going to walk away in an individual sport. You know, you think about boxing, you think about golf. Obviously, Tiger Woods, at the time that we're talking, has undergone a great comeback and won the Tour Championship golf tournament in October of 2018. I'm not saying that he would have done it or should have done it, but wouldn't it have been Hollywood, wouldn't it have been great if that's his walk-off moment? I'm leaving. I've come back from injury. I don't need the money. I don't need any more wins. I'm going to leave in this moment. I mean, sure, he still believes at this moment while we're talking in 2019, I can win major championships and chase down Jack Nicklaus's record. Who knows if he ever gets another major championship? I'm just relating it to that was an individual moment where he won that tournament, not a major, proved I can come back from injury and win again after, what, a 4 or 5 year absence of not having won a golf tournament, at least a 3 or 4 year absence of not having won a golf tournament, and walk away like that, or walk away as a stock car driver from winning the Daytona 500 like Tom Cruise. It's no different than in other facets of professional life. If you do something individually, win some kind of award, some kind of honor, somebody that's an Oscar winner on Oscar night makes that their final film. I won the Academy Award. I'm not acting anymore, for example. Something like
that. Well,
this
one, though, as bad as the Tiger season was, it'd be like if you won Best Actor for a terrible movie. You know what I mean? Or like, you know, we mentioned Tiger, if he'd gone out and won a tournament after all of his scandal and then quit. You know?
Right, but maybe we relate it to you had done a series of bad movies, and you now put together one more great movie, you win the Academy Award, and now I am retiring. That's my final movie. I go out with the walk-off, go out on top. Go out with the greatest accomplishment there of something like that. So it works. It works for that regard. All right, critics. Give me critics.
I've got one. And in fact, Roger Ebert's one we usually go to from Siskel and Ebert, and he agrees with Mrs. Reeves. he's not a fan.
This.
He gave it 2 stars out of 4. And he rips it pretty good. Here's one point in kind of in the middle of his review. He says, the movie has a screenplay that lumbers between past and present like regret on a death march. Billy suits up for his final game of the season. As he starts pitching, we get the 5 year earlier card. And the movie cuts back and forth between his quest to pitch a perfect game and his memories of a love affair. Will he pitch the perfect game and save the relationship? Or will they throw a home run in the bottom of the ninth while the girl disappears? What do you think? So essentially, he's kind of calling the Hollywood stuff like you did. Continuing on, he says, the ending is routine, false crisis, false dawn, real crisis, real dawn. Only a logician would wonder why these two people meet in the first place, where neither of them have the slightest reason to be. And then thinking back to the movie, I cannot recall a single thing either character said that was worth hearing in their own right,
wow,
apart from the requirements of the plot.
Well, we should make mention that most of the time when you're giving these reviews, Roger Ebert was favorable, if not very much bullish, on the movie that we're talking about. But in this case, not
very
case.
True. Yes, very, very true. I mean, he, you know, for the most part, too, the movies we do are blockbusters that a lot of people love. This is one that we kind of love, and it kind of coincides with the beginning of Major League Baseball season. It's one we've talked about doing for a long time. You know, I think we said this back kind of when a couple of movies ago when we did The Hangover. Most of the ones we do for everyone that are listening every now and then, we'll do one for us. And this was one for us. So that was his take on it. We'll go over to Variety, which is the famous publication out there in Los Angeles for the people in the movie industry. And they have says few genres have consistently landed in the cellar as often as baseball movies. But Kevin Costner, it goes on and on. It basically says Kevin Costner knows what he's doing when it comes to the baseball movies. It says, as an All-American, All Hollywood as a movie can get in the late 90s for Love of the Game, represents a personal comeback for the star and the best combo of his strengths as romantic lead and athletic guy with Ron Shelton, formerly of Tin Cup, and Bull Durham.
This one,
it's a little more favorable than Roger Ebert's.
All right, so a couple more things. We'll go through a couple of trivia things in a couple of moments, but I want to hit you with this before we get out of here on For the Love of the Game. You like this one better than Bull Durham? Why or why not? 10 years earlier?
That's tough.
It's easy for me. Bull Durham I like better. I like this one, but I like Bull Durham better. Maybe because it's a comedy with the love story. I like Bull Durham better than this one. I'm not saying I didn't like this one. I obviously did. I like Bull Durham better. But you're torn?
Here's what I'll say. For me personally, I really enjoy both of them. If I had to recommend one, I would probably recommend Bull Durham because I think it's more enjoyable. I think For Love of the Game might be about 15, 20 minutes too long. You know, they could have shaved a few parts of it here and there. And Bull Durham was about as good as it gets for this kind of movie.
Okay, and so similar plot lines here in other Costner sports movies. Let's go all the way back to American Flyers, the cycling movie, and I'm not going to go through the whole movie. I'm just going to go through that it's the premise is he is a cyclist that has had great success. He's older. He's not at the very end of his career, but he's obviously very sick. But he's doing very well in a cycling race, and his brother, his younger brother, is actually got a chance to win the cycling race, and there's a love interest involved, so it's similar in the theme or the type of movie. So I would say to you, American Flyers or For the Love of the Game, which one would you choose on that? Similar Kevin Costner, similar love interest, yes, different plot, different kind of ending. But
since he didn't die in this one, I'll take For Love of the Game, but I did like American Flyers.
American Flyers is great, and that's a tough comparison there because it's not a comedy. It's a more serious one. It's got some love interest in it. Then we fast forward to the draft day movie where he's the GM of the Cleveland Browns, Costner playing Sonny Weaver, and Jennifer Garner is the female lead, and she is working as a front office executive on the salary cap, and they have a love interest. And Sonny Weaver is maybe on the verge of being fired if he doesn't work things out on this draft day. Does he really know what he's doing? They have their whole love situation through all of this. I don't think draft day works as well as For the Love of the Game 15 years later. I like it for being a sports movie. Again, I'm a sports fan, and I work for an NFL team. But I take For the Love of the Game over draft day. They're trying to do kind of the same thing. What about you?
Draft day is in fact, it might be more unbelievable than For Love of the Game. The fact that the owner is able to fly from New York to Cleveland in a matter of like three draft picks is one of those that I'll never figure out how that happened. You know, and I mean, it's very, very entertaining. In fact, I could even see us doing that one when the NFL draft comes around, perhaps. But movie wise and quality wise, I would probably
take
this one. You've got Sam Raimi directed this, a great director. Ivan Reitman directed Draft Day, another great director. I mean, you know, these movies you're listing, you can't really go wrong with either of them, but I think I'm going to go baseball on this one.
If we're doing the baseball analogy, For the Love of the Game is a home run, and Draft Day is probably a double. Some would say it's a single. I would probably give it a double on that one, but it's similar in that it's an intertwined love story. A theme with Costner. And again, you go back to Open Range, right? That's a cowboy western shoot 'em up, but the love story is intertwined between Costner and Annette Bening in that one. So there's different movies that he has made where the love story is intertwined. And again, we go back to No Way Out, where the love story is part of the drama, the espionage, the swerve, the whole thing with Hackman and with Sean Young. So it's not uncommon for Costner to be intertwined with a love story, and in some of the sports movies it just works better than others. I think it does work in this movie. I think it really does.
Well, and there's another one. It's not necessarily a sports movie, but Kevin Costner was in Revenge in 1990 with Anthony Quinn and Madeline Stowe, and he's playing tennis at the beginning. He went down to play tennis and hunt with Anthony Quinn. So we throw a little tennis in there. I really, really enjoy Revenge. My favorite director of all time, the late Tony Scott, he made it. If you haven't ever seen it, it's one to go find. It's not one of his bigger movies.
Because
it came out the spring, because Dance with Wolves came out that fall.
Gotcha.
But go ahead.
Because, as it turns out in the plot line, Costner is cheating on Anthony Quinn's marriage with his wife, and that's where
his much younger wife.
That's where
they're instantly attracted. They fall in love,
and that whole movie gets set into motion with that. So again, he's not unfamiliar with the love.
You can say it. All hell breaks loose when Anthony Quinn finds out.
There's no doubt on what's going to happen next. So love Kevin Costner. Love him in this movie. I wanted to mention you got any trivia nuggets? Because I got a couple myself, and then we've got a roll here because
before we wrap this up, just a couple fun things I found. At the very beginning, it shows the World Series 1984 banner from the Tigers Padres World Series that the Tigers won.
Yes.
The shot of Billy's parents are actually Kevin Costner's parents.
How about that?
That's pretty cool.
They go to that at the beginning of the movie, and then they go to that when he's trying to finish off the perfect game. So I did not realize that. Did not know that on that one. I've got a trivia nugget because he's even mentioned by name the first base umpire that is calling the out on the out safe at the very end of the perfect game is an umpire that lives in my area, the Tampa Bay area, Rich Garcia, who I happen to know. Richie Garcia is a very famous former American League umpire. He calls the final out. Garcia also famous because, Jay, 3 years earlier, he was involved in the controversial Derek Jeter home run where the young Yankee fan Jeffrey Mayer reached over the fence.
Gosh.
If you see that replay again, go YouTube it, kids. Rich Garcia is very famously the umpire who didn't have a great angle, and he's calling it a home run live. There's no instant replay. Garcia is the ump, and that memory has stood with him for 25 years. I've known Rich for 20-plus years. He's cool with it. He understands that instant replay would have corrected it. It didn't correct it in that day in a playoff game. You just got to live with it on the call. I saw Richie Garcia about a month ago before the start of this baseball season and got a chance to talk with him. He still plays golf. He's still around. He's the first base umpire in this movie for the love of the game that's calling the final out there on that. So that's pretty cool as a quick little trivia nugget and a cameo, a real Major League Baseball umpire.
No, for sure. I've got a couple more. I've got Dave Island, who was a relief pitcher in Major League Baseball, and he went on. He would be the pitching coach for the Royals and the Mets later on.
Dave Island.
Dave Island was Costner's pitching double.
You don't know this. Dave Island, I need to interject, who is from Zephyr Hills, Florida, about 15 minutes from where I live, who is a former New York Yankee pitcher himself, famous Jay, among all the other accolades and now being a pitching coach. But go ahead with what he did in the movie.
He was in the far away shots. He was Kevin Costner's pitching double.
And that's where that part would come in, because Island was a fairly successful, not great high level, but fairly successful pitcher in the big leagues and very well known in this area in the 80s and the 90s for being a pitcher and eventually the pitching coach also for the New York Yankees, in addition to being a pitching coach for the other teams that he's been with. So that's pretty cool how they intertwine. Although Costner, you see some different parts of his athleticism. Now, it's interesting if you go back to the archive and listen to our baseball movies one with Rob Dibble, he gives his takes on this, and I will not reveal it. I will not spoil it. Go back and listen to what he thinks about Costner in Bull Durham and For the Love of the Game and what Dibbs has to say about that and about other players playing baseball characters and who pulled it off or not. Is that a good tease for them to go listen to that one?
For sure. That's a fun one to listen to anyways, because Dibble was so much fun to have on. Here's the last thing I've got. In fact, this goes back to something we were talking about earlier. I kind of cheated and did a little research while we were working here. According to Kevin Costner, Yankees owner George Steinbrenner was agitated that the Yankees would be seen losing in a movie filmed on location at Yankee Stadium. Costner was able to calm Steinbrenner down by explaining that Billy Chappell and not the game itself was the movie's major focus. Costner also explained that the game would mean nothing to the Yankees and it was not a winner-take-all scenario. Costner convinced Steinbrenner in the movie's universe the Yankees would still clinch the ALDS the next day, keeping alive their World Series chances. Costner added that he later received a Yankees 1999 World Series ring as a thank you gift for filming the movie from George Steinbrenner.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Because, again, in the weeks after this movie in 99, they won the third of three World Championships in 4 years that eventually became four World Championships in 5 years when they won again in 2000. And one more nugget, I'm kind of revealing something about the Reeves' personal life. The late George Steinbrenner, who passed away a few years ago, has been a very benevolent figure in the Tampa Bay area for a lot of years. The Yankees renamed their training complex Steinbrenner Field, where they train every spring. They're playing at the time that Jay and I are talking right now, spring training games at Steinbrenner Field. I sit and do this podcast in the shadow of George M. Steinbrenner High School, famous Jay. My twins, if all things remain equal and we're still living where we live, will go to George M. Steinbrenner High School eventually in a few years. But the boss is still the boss, and he wanted to make sure how the Yankees would be portrayed in For the Love of the Game. So I like that on the trivia. And how cool is that nugget that he gave Costner a World Series ring? I never had it. That's why you're the famous Jay. You come up with these
things.
That's
really cool. Now, that's why I have the internet, thank goodness. It actually works sometimes. There's one thing actually I've written down. I covered it up with all these sheets of paper I forgot to mention. This one was kind of odd, but I found it a couple places, so I guess it's legit. It says that Kevin Costner was angry with Universal Pictures because they cut a full frontal shower scene. Costner told Newsweek that the studio lacked real courage by insisting the film be more kid-friendly and earn a PG-13 rating instead of an R rating.
Because it's a shower scene, with he and...
Full frontal nudity, yes. Like we had with Kevin Bacon in Wild Things.
I don't know that we necessarily needed to see all of that. And so, but, you know, they're in some ways, the filmmakers... The actor-directors and producer-directors, they're artists, but the movie works without having to see all that we had to see.
Well, here's the reaction. A studio executive told New York Magazine, a test audience in Arizona gave it a thumbs down. The audience giggled at the scene, and focus groups said, do we really need to see that?
Exactly.
So I guess that's our answer, and I mean, for one, I'm glad that we didn't have it. I thought it was a good movie the way it was. Like I said, it might have been a tad long. It ran 2 hours and 17 minutes. I probably could have done with right about 2 hours. But unless you're talking about Heat, T.J. Reeves, I don't really like too many movies that are over 2 hours.
I would agree with that. We love Heat with De Niro, Pacino, and the L.A. crime story. And we'll do that at some point, as we've seen that from the 1990s. But this one works. It's not my all-time favorite Costner. I wouldn't say that, but it's good, and it's a good baseball movie with the season coming up. And we encourage the folks, I know we've talked a lot about it, and we've even told you how things end up, but it's still worth it to go watch the love story and intertwine and enjoy For the Love of the Game.
Now, at the time we're recording this, is currently running on Cinemax. So if you have the Cinemax app, you can go watch it whenever you want or on demand.
Go find it online as well if you like. It's definitely worthwhile to get you ready for the baseball season. I think we had some fun here on... this edition of We've Seen That for the Love of the Game. You have fun, Famous Jay?
I always have fun talking to our friends on We've Seen That. Thanks a lot, everybody.
All right, and thank you to the audience. Again, we encourage you to subscribe. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. The latest episode will come automatically to your device, your phone, your iPad. Follow us on social media. Go to Twitter or Facebook. The Twitter, We've Seen That, or the Facebook page of We've Seen That. Keep you up to date on all the movies and all the shows that we do. Go sort through our catalog. As we like to say, we've got everything from Die Hard to White Men Can't Jump to Caddyshack to The Fugitive to The Bodyguard, Days of Thunder, Rocky IV. There's something for everybody. Baseball movies with Rob Dibble, on and on down the list, including sports movies like this one, For the Love of the Game. And that will do it for this edition of our movies podcast from the 80s, the 90s, and more. It is We've Seen That for the famous Jay Betzel. Follow him at the famous Jay on Twitter, by the way. I am merely TJ Reeves. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you for being with us on For the Love of the Game.
This is a Crush Performance Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
And of course, if you've been following the news lately, you've heard about the college admissions scandal. It got me thinking about college sport. And a tweet that came out from our good friends at the Florida Baseball Ranch earlier this week that I just had to respond to. Randy Sullivan and the guys there are top shelf for sure. You can follow them at FL Baseball Ranch. And here's the tweet that they sent out. The college recruiting process is out of control. Guys are expected to be ready at 14. Bigger, more mature players are committed as 8th and 9th graders, only to have their commitment broken days, weeks before their signing day. Randy continues to write that a 13-year-old came in last night saying, "I'm going to be a dude, mark my words." Listen, you don't know if a 13-year-old's going to be a dude, so I had to respond to this. Here's what I wrote. "Randy, I agree with you 100%. Parents and players, beware. Keep your expectations realistic. Do not specialize early. 10 to 12 years on the bottom end for sure. Find a great program, dive in, and enjoy the ride because it's a process that takes years. Getting better is fun if you do it the right way." That was my response to Randy's tweet. I don't typically write back to social media posts, but I had to on that one because he's so right. It is out of control. People, we have to take our time when it comes to development. I think we rush it too much. It comes back to the whole specialization conversation, right? I mean, we just have to make sure that our athletes are enjoying sport through those critical developmental ages. And there are windows of opportunity in terms of development, very, very distinct windows that have to be addressed in the process of developing an athlete over time. You cannot rush it, especially when it comes to strength. Listen, the weight room is a very dangerous place to be. You do the wrong thing at the wrong time, you can totally crush future potential. So proceed with caution.
Crush Performance with Jeff Kreshel can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.